Hello, dear listeners. As of March 16th, CKUT Studios will be closed until further notice. The programming on our airwaves will consist of a mixture of recent CKUT archives, new pre-recorded segments, and other relevant special programming. Our upcoming funding drive will be postponed until further notice. Thank you for understanding that we are taking these measures to protect the health of our staff and community members. Love, CKUT.
And welcome to Silver Threads, where we are still walking, still waking. And I'm Carla.
And I'm Eleanor. And this is the show where we trace our present path through the people and stories of the past. As we ourselves, long-term radicals, learn about each other, from each other, and continue to walk, continue to wake. This week, we are joined by Katie Pettit, who re-envisions community-driven initiatives as a new basis for racial justice, global solidarity, and peace-building. Pettit is the founder and executive director of Current Movements, a DC-based organization connecting grassroots movements through art, film, and technology. She is also an arts and cultural organizer in DC, where she has organized with groups such as Black Lives Matter DC, Movement for Black Lives DC, and DC Mutual Aid Network. Pettit brings her love of the arts to her consulting work, where she focuses on strategic planning and organizational culture, event planning, storytelling, conflict transformation, exhibition curation, and fundraising. Previously, Pettit managed the advocacy projects, programs, and DC office, including its Peace Fellowship program, which partnered with 14 grassroots organizations in 10 countries. As a fellow at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey Center for Conflict Studies, Pettit conducted field research on water conflicts in Ethiopia and worked for over 5 years in refugee resettlement in three major U.S. cities. Pettit received a master's degree in international peace studies from the UN Mandated University for Peace and an undergraduate degree in peace studies from Whitworth University. Pettit is currently the Eaton Workshop Impact Director, working with grassroots partners and community initiatives to fulfill Eaton's mission of furthering progressive social change. Thanks so much for being here, Katie.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. Such a treat.
Hi, Katie. I love talking with Eleanor's friends and co-organizers. It's always so joyful. So thanks for being here. Our first question is, we like to look a little bit to the past and ask our guests to take us on a little historical journey or walk with you through some watershed moments, perhaps when your thinking really shifted or you got involved with some organizing.
Some watershed moments. I think the story I tell a lot about how I knew I wanted to get involved is around when I was 7 years old. I was going from my mom's house to my dad's family's house. And so I'm from Texas. I was born and spent half of my first years in Houston, Texas. And my family, my dad's family is in Seguin, which is like rural central Texas. And it's actually where my family were enslaved. And so they've been on that land since Juneteenth and since they were freed. And so I remember being there in the car, kind of coming to Seguin and thinking about how different my families are. So my mom, she's white, and a lot of the family that I lived with in Houston are white. And then my family in Seguin, like I said, are black. So thinking about like the different, like, why there was so much disparity in like what they had and the opportunities and the finances and that kind of stuff. And like, the only thing I could come to was like the skin color of my family were different. And I was just like, oh, like, this is not okay. And I recognize that I have privilege, that my, my Black family, my Black cousins don't have in going to like all white schools and private schools. And I wanted to use that privilege so that my family and families like mine, like, wouldn't have to suffer anymore and wouldn't have like this like overarching oppression just because of the color of their skin. So it's my organizing, I think, really started young. And it drove me to study peace studies in college, where I didn't really, I learned a lot about like the civil rights movements and different movements around the world, but I didn't really understand how they won and how they, like, even in textbooks, when you're like researching at that level, it's just kind of like, then this person did this thing and it was great. And I was just like, but how? And so I went through this long career journey that maybe we will get into. But I left and decided that like the nonprofit world is not for me. And I just wanted to know more about the underground, is how I thought about it in my head. It's like, there's this underground current happening where things are getting done and I don't understand how, but I want to know how and who these people are. And so through another long story, I ended up going to Standing Rock as a Black Lives Matter, global network representative, and my intention was to learn and to listen and to grow in that really beautiful special space, and also just to discover how movements happen and how organizing happens and how great change really happens. And so I feel like I'm still on that journey, and I feel really lucky to be a part of it with both of you. And you know, it's so many comrades in DC and, you know, out in the wide world.
Rad. Yeah, I think, I mean, you pinpointed the point of this show is like, we're still on this journey. We're still learning. We're still walking and figuring shit out as we go on on these paths. So, as part of that, like, we like to ask folks to be a bit vulnerable, because one of the things that that frustrates us both about some movement spaces is that it makes it look like everyone comes in prepackaged, knowing what the fuck is going on. And like, I was always this radical and I always knew all of the things. And, you know, to quote Malcolm X, there was a time where you didn't know what you know. And so we like to ask folks, what do you look back on in your past and go, ugh? Or, you know, kind of like smile and go, oh, younger me. And realized that at that point that you needed to grow on your journey.
Yeah. Such a good question and definitely hard. I feel like there's been so many points where I'm just like, ooh, cringe. Why did I say that or do that or think that? But yeah, it, like you said, you don't know what you don't know. And it also, like, I think is good to hold on to. So we are gentle and compassionate and empathetic with baby organizers or baby, you know, like, because we weren't all here forever. And yeah, I still have so much more to go. And then thank you, younger generations, for like pushing me and all of us. Something that comes to mind is a few years ago we did, well, I guess the bigger, broader point of it this last year, I've been thinking a lot about how it feels like we're in an ebb of our movements where things are like quiet and sleepy and contentious. And there's a lot of infighting and conflicts. And I think that's a part of movements. I think we are constantly in those ebbs and flows. And so the last 4 years, especially I think with Trump, there's been a lot of movement. There's been a lot of like flow, a lot of like, go, 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 go. A lot getting done, a lot of like excitement, a lot of like attendance at all of these things people want to be talking about. racial justice and climate justice and like immigration. And now it's like, please don't tell me anything bad. Like, I just want to have my brunch and be in peace. And I get it. Like, it's been a really fucking hard couple of years and 4 years and lifetime. So I totally get it. So no shade, but this is just where we are. And so I've been thinking a lot about how that's heartbreaking too, to come out of the Trump era, to come out of what was possible with mutual aid and quarantine and the uprising last year and a really beautiful like 7 years of the BLM movement. And it's heartbreaking to see that this world's not a whole lot different by and by, and we're still here. And so getting back to your question, like I used to think that, oh, if we just did like the right combination of people and brilliant minds or the right meeting, like I used to do a lot of like logistics and coordination of the Black Lives Matter DC meetings and the Movement for Black Lives meetings. We would have 1,000 people out like all the time. And like, oh, this meeting or this protest or this action, or we did a really cool and beautiful and hard and messy and like definitely one of those like cringe moments, like Katie, there's so many mistakes there. We did this, what do we call it? Root to Rise conference on a farm in Virginia, where we were really thinking about like, what would it mean to live together? And what would it mean to like grow food together and grow together and like on the land? And how do we do that in an interracial, interclass way where we acknowledge the Native people who lived there first and the enslaved people who grew that land? And like so many things went wrong and so many things, like so many of those relationships aren't even in existence anymore. And, but I had like so much hope. I was like, this is it. And this is how I'm spending the next 60 years of my life, you know? And it's not that. And so, yeah, I think a lot of the cringiness is like, oh, where do I find hope now? You know, like, how do I not stay jaded, or how do I not become jaded, and how do I stay in hope and stay like motivated after having like so many experiences that were great and beautiful, but also like really, really hard and devastating and like have challenged my notions of what's needed, what's possible, like who I am, where my leadership skills lie, like, yeah, lots of learning, lots of growing, but that's what I would say.
Thank you so much. I really love what you weave there together. I also did my schooling in peace and conflict studies and also hit a wall. I specialized in genocide studies and was trying to change the UN secretly, you know, just a little thing like that, and was so disconnected and went the other direction and had that same kind of like things happen at the underground and are, you know, below the ground. But then it gets just as messy there. And I'm curious, like, this is kind of a going off the path a bit. We ask about what radicalism means to you, where you're living now, but I'm also like with that, cause you're kind of getting at like the kind of the threads that are in peace and conflict and what in movements and all that. And like, you know, what does that look like in DC right now? And, what does radicalism mean to you where you're living and existing in these days?
Okay. Two part question. The second part is, what does radicalism look like to me now? And the first part is,
I'm curious about like how like studying peace and conflict and focusing on that, informs, how you navigate these kind of conflicts that are important when we're up against, the institutions and the racism and the up against empire that holds us subjugated.
Yeah. I'm so grateful for my peace education. I think it's, you know, not necessary at all. to do this work, but I do love it. And I love history, and I love what that can do to, like, what history can inform for our practice now and into the future. And so much of history is a pattern. And so it helps me, I think, to be a little more like bird's eye view of some situations where I can say, like, oh, I know enough about movement history and political history, and like international history and like the beginnings of the UN and all of those things, to know that, like, if X plus Y, then Z, you know, and this is what's going to happen, and to kind of couch my expectations in that. And I think I studied peace and conflict studies, but I was way more interested. There's a lot of like components of peace and conflict studies and like tracks. And I was always way more interested in the kind of community development track of it. And I really, really, really fought doing conflict resolution since the beginning. And I had a mentor in undergrad who was like, who would put on these trainings for conflict resolution and was just like, Katie, you need to come. You'd be so good at it. And I was just like, no way. Who wants to spend their free time like sorting out someone's conflict? Like, that just sounds miserable and hard and like gross. Why? So I just really, really fought that part of it. And although it was like a part of the readings, a part of the trainings, throughout undergrad and grad school, I wanted nothing to do with it. And lo and behold, when you start organizing, there's so much conflict and someone's got to do the mediation and help, you know, usher people to some kind of transformation or solution or alternative. And that definitely became a role that I've played a lot in DC in my organizing time, for better or worse. Like, definitely don't tote my like perfection in it, because it's so messy, right? To like be a part of those processes. But yeah, my background has been a huge part in that kind of role and understanding the importance of it, and understanding that like, If I can't figure out conflict in myself, which is like an ongoing, you know, journey and path and goal, and if I can't figure it out interpersonally and like collectively, like how am I as like a person who wants peace globally, like how am I supposed to operate if I can't figure out those things first? So, yeah, I think peace and conflict studies really does like ground you in like, okay, you need to like, everything is macro and micro and micro and macro. And we need to look at it all at once, because that's where change happens. And to your second question, radicalism to me, and I think this has been pretty consistent, so I don't think it's new. But it's really like living my passion and like aligning my life to that. But beyond that, like, what does my community need, and being of service? And that comes from Aaron Goggins, who's one of the founders of BLM DC. And he looks at a Venn diagram that's like, okay, what is my passion and what makes my soul sing, he says, and what is my community need, and how do I live at the center of those two things? And so for me, like, being truly radical is that intersection. And it's also my vision for liberation. And so I work really hard, or at least I try to create a community and space and place for not just me to try and live at that intersection, but more and more people. yeah, like how, what would the world look like if we were all able to say, like, I'm going to live my passion, be it journalism or podcasting or making films or art or gardening or cooking or, you know, whatever it is, being a doctor, but not in like the shitty system. And looking at like, okay, what does my community need? How do I use being a doctor outside of a harmful system to serve my community in the most meaningful way? Like if we could all do that, what would the world look like? And I think capitalism and the systems of oppression that we live in work to keep us away from that intersection really, really well. Like it's a very efficient system to like get you to do things that like you don't want to be doing and to like suck your life force. And then also to divide us so we don't have like that collective power when we are able to serve our community day in and day out. So yeah, that's what I hope for. That's what I work for. That's what I'm always trying to like carve out in my life. Sometimes successfully, sometimes not.
Well, I can say from my vantage point, you're doing an amazing job.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
So this is, it's kind of a two part as well. And you kind of touched upon it already, but I wanted to like dig in a little bit more. You know, you mentioned how you're feeling about this particular moment and, you know, that, I mean, we've noticed that in our mutual aid group too, like some people just wandered off when Biden was elected. I'm like, wait, he's just a different flavor of rapist, racist, piece of shit, war criminal.
Exactly.
So I guess the kind of two part question is, what scares you, or makes you feel unsure about this current time, this current journey that you're on? And do you have more or less hope? And if you mm-hmm. do, like, what kind of hope is that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I facilitate the biweekly mutual aid calls for DC Mutual Aid Network. And we've been doing it for a year and I don't know, 7-8 months now, every other week, which has been really incredible to like get to know these folks over Zoom and phone calls. And now in person more over such a long period of time and to see them to learn and grow. And a lot of them new to organizing and movement work. But to be just very clearly stand on like the shoulders of all the work that's been done before them, especially amongst like Black femme organizers in DC. So it's been like a really cool journey, but at the top of the summer, maybe in July or so, we had this call where, yeah, like what you were saying, Eleanor, it was happening where, so many of the groups, there's, 8 groups that participate in the call. So Ward 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, East of the River, and the Facebook moderators. And, a lot of them were talking about like, we have a huge drop off on funds, a huge drop off in numbers of, volunteers or organizers, people who are able to continue this work. And it was really heartbreaking for them and heartbreaking to hear about, because like so much beautiful organizing and connection and relationship building and support had happened over the course of a year plus. And to see that kind of drop off so quickly, really hurt them, like hurt their spirits. And I think a lot of it is because of like what was possible. Like there was so much hope in more and more people opening up their eyes to what alternative lifestyles can be led and like what anarchism can do for us as people and us as a community and how mutual aid can serve in that and how like how mutual aid starts to allow that Venn diagram to happen, you know? And, you know, working from home and having your bills cut in half. If you have like a job that will allow that, allows you to like go meet your neighbor and like go hang out and like figure out ways that you can mutually learn from one another and be together. Like there's so much beauty that happened. And yeah, it's definitely heartbreaking to see that not come to fruition in any kind of like systemic change. But I think what gives me hope is that it's still happening and it's going to continue to happen. And there's like folks like the Peace House who've been doing mutual aid since Occupy. And there's churches and community groups and housing collectives and co-ops and land trusts that have been doing this work for generations in DC and in the DMV. And then, you know, as people of color, like, this is how we survive is through this work. And so I know it's not going to disappear. I think it's like, yeah, what I was talking about before, where it's like, if we just have this one thing and all the stars align, then boom, like the whole system will fall. And we have like this beautiful, much more kind, much more giving and generous, like system ready for everyone to fall into, you know, like, and I think it's just not like that. but I don't think that that means that it's the end forever and, you know, nothing more will happen. I think it's like, oh, in 2 weeks or whatever it was, like mutual aid was able to grow to thousands of volunteers and organizers and help politicize so many people and help like get people what they needed in that time. And was able to show people a different way of life. And that's going to stick with people, even if they have to go back to waiting tables, like, and working five jobs or, you know, like had to move out of the city and so can no longer participate. That work's going to stay with people. And I'm hopeful that, yeah, this work will continue. One of the organizers that we would meet with in this call would say that it's not a race. It's not a marathon. This work is a pilgrimage. And so that's what we would say all the time is just like, keep going. It's a pilgrimage. You know, there's going to be stops along the way. It's a spiritual journey. Like, and it's just, this work is continuous. So yeah, I have hope. It's hard to see the trees through the forest sometimes, but, or the forest through the trees, I don't know what the saying is. But I do have hope that, we're moving in the right direction.
Well, that was beautiful. There's so many threads to pull or to weave. Thank you. I think was thinking about the drop off, and every time that happens in my organizing after all these years, I always think about the Zapatista started with six people. And it just always grounds me back into presence with the six people in the room or the four or the five or the 10. And yeah, I love that. The pilgrimage thing is really cool, and or intergenerational, you know, like, and I think like you touched on this earlier, but it's connected and you said it again, but, like paying attention to the histories. Like I saw a tweet the other day of somebody saying that mutual aid is just a new word for, community. And I was like, what is even happening? So like, I think it's some, you know, and as someone who's a bit older and organizing, like you often have to sit in that nuance and that messy place with new people and new people to the movement of like their awakening and or their experimentation, but also being like, you know, I read this quote that information is like compost. It's no use if unless it's spread around, and like knowing when to say, well, actually mutual aid is who we are. Like there's no beginning. It just has always been. And, So I love that you seem to bring that to your work.
You're listening to Silver Threads, part of the Grounded Futures multimedia platform.
For more information and to donate to our totally ad-free show, check out groundedfutures.com. You can reach out to us with thoughts and suggestions at silverthreadsshow@protonmail.com. You can find out more about our host Eleanor via artkillingapathy.com and our host Carla via joyfulthreadsproductions.com.
1212, tune in for another episode of Marooncast. Marooncast is a down-to-earth black radical podcast for the people. Our host, hip-hop anarchist Simile the RBG, and sex educator and crochet artist KLC share their reflections on maroons, rebellions, womanism, life, culture, community, trap liberation, and everyday ratchetness. They deliver fresh commentary with the queer, trans, gender non-conforming, fierce, funny, Southern girls, anti-imperialist, anti-oppression approach. Polyad and bullshit. Check out episodes of Marooncast on Channel Zero Network, Buzzsprout, SoundCloud, Google, Apple, and Spotify. All power to the people, all pleasure to the people. Peace.
And now, back to the show.
I'm really excited to hear what you have to say about this question about somebody we interviewed asked us it. And so we've carried it into our show, and it's this idea of scaling over. Like, so we're, and you kind of touched on it a bit, saying that, you know, things kind of went back to normal after Biden and, you know, empire marches on. And, but like, you know, what gets in the way of us, like, really scaling over? Like, why can't mutual aid sustain and, or grow? And I love the idea of the seeds that you talked about, that people have to go back, but it's there, just got to keep watering it. But yeah, like, do you have more thoughts on why we can't really scale over, or seem to, even historically, and pulling that thread into the present, maybe into the future?
Yeah, it's such a good question. I want to listen to the episode of whoever brought that up.
Hmm. I'm just going to say her name is Marina Sutrin.
Great. Okay. I don't know. And it is something I think a lot about, and maybe we weren't meant to, you know, like, you're going to ask about books recommendations. And the best book I read last year was, Braiding Sweetgrass. And right now I'm reading her earlier book, Robin Wall Kimmerer. And she has an earlier book about moss. And I just love, I listen to it on audio. I love listening to her voice. I want her to be my best friend and adopted mother. Like, we're just going to make it happen. And my girlfriend's mom actually just met her, and I was like, perfect. Cause it's coming together. I'm manifesting this. So in this book about moss, so she's a biologist and a native woman, and looks at her work through both lenses of, like, indigenous knowledge and scientific knowledge, and really asks the question of, like, what can plants teach us? But then how can we be reciprocal to plants themselves? And in the moss book, she's talking a lot about how, like, life and death and growth and sustainability. And I recently lost my grandmother, so I've been thinking about the same thing of just, like, how, like, life is so short and fragile and important and also seemingly meaningless at the same time. And how do we, like, what does it all mean, right? And I think if we're looking at plants, like, there's such a, like, purpose to it. And there's, like, medicine from plants, and they have, like, so many lessons to teach us. And so maybe some of it is, like, the real rich work that we do maybe isn't meant to be the system that we live in. Maybe it's meant to be the undercurrent. Like you said, like, mutual aid is who we are. It's a being, you know? And even, like, as I read more about anarchism and Black anarchism, like, it's not meant to be a system or a structure, you know, because then it would be oppressive. And so, like, how would we even scale up the work that we do is something that I've been thinking more about. Like, maybe it's not meant to be. And I definitely want all of us to be practicing this. And I want, you know, to evangelize the people on our work and movements and to join, get involved and join something. But maybe if it gets to a certain level, it starts to lose like its essence and its medicine for what we're trying to do here. I don't know.
I'm hijacking, coming in real quick, just to say that, yay, Robin, I wanted to, have you heard her, it's on a podcast, actually, and a written piece essay about the service berries. I really recommend it. We'll put it in the show notes. It gets to everything you're saying. And she looks at the service berry, which in Canada, it's called the Saskatoon berry, which I just got delighted because it's always been my favorite berry. And I, for my birthday, since I was a little kid, I've had a Saskatoon berry pie. She just uses the service berry as the ultimate reciprocity example of mutual aid living in the everyday. So I just wanted to put a plug for that. I just love your answer. I'm just going to say, I love it. I'm right there with you. I'm going to hand the baton over to Eleanor.
Thanks. Yes. I too love that answer. And I mean, it's a unique answer, which I also love. And it's kind of like basically saying, well, yeah, maybe the whole point is to be in these smaller ecosystems that are obviously connected, but they're not, it's not like we have one ecosystem for the whole world. And it also reminds me of something that like Robin Wall Kimmerer talks about in Braiding Sweetgrass, which is like that science is catching up to Indigenous knowledge in so many ways. So like there's this, like it's called Dunbar's number. And it says that, you know, basically science and research has shown that human beings can work with up to 150 people before there's a need for a hierarchy, because we can't communicate effectively with more than 150 people. And yeah, and if you look historically, like we've lived in smaller groups where we've just organized that way because that felt natural and it felt like being who we are, which is that mutual aid framework. So, you know, with that kind of the idea of like, you know, blending concepts and envisioning a future that is based on liberation and justice, particularly with the work that you do. I mean, it's so much based in creativity. How do you feel that imagination fits into creating new worlds?
So I have this candle that my friend Joseph Orzel made for an exhibition he did a few years back. I think the exhibition was called Now More Than Ever. And it was, I believe, in 2016, right after Trump was elected. But he made these cool candles. I mean, like he just bought like cheap candles and then put these letters on it. So every candle has mostly bell hooks quotes on them. But this one says, "What we cannot imagine cannot come into being." And so I think that's it. Like if we can't use our imaginations to come up with alternative ways of being, then we won't ever get there. And imagination is like a really difficult thing. It's not something we're taught or encouraged in school, and we lose practice in it. And it's one of my favorite parts about being an organizer, and especially like working with folks who are new to organizing, new to movements, is to like encourage them to expand their sense of imagination. And I just remember like, so while after I quit my job, I was a full-time organizer, like volunteer, living on credit cards and things, you know, like the universe being good to me. And I would also facilitate different groups on like future planning for a law firm, for their organization and their board, or like conflict mediation for different nonprofits, or racial justice, like DEI, JEDI type work, to make money here and there. And one of the first gigs that I ever got, so I was doing Movement for Black Lives facilitation, Black Lives Matter DC. I was doing some Resist This stuff, like post J20 organizing. So I was doing all of this and facilitating with this law firm, and they were trying to imagine what their work could be into the future. And it was like pulling teeth, just getting them to, like, it's their organization. They are lawyers. I know nothing about, you know, what they were like. I read their website and that was it. But I was just like, okay, now you get to decide, like, or dream about, like, what comes next and how are we going to get there together? Like, we'll map out a plan. And they couldn't do it. Like, these brilliant people, a lot of them have worked in embassies and UN. And I was just like kind of dumbfounded, because so much of what I was doing in my organizing day to day was imagining, was dreaming, was visioning of, like, okay, we want our collective future to look like this. And, like, we want to abolish the prison industrial complex here in DC. And this is how we're going to get it. We're going to do X, Y, and Z. And we need these pieces to go into place. And so many more people are like the lawyers than like organizers. And how do we get more people able to imagine? And in current movements, a lot of what I want us to do is to show, like, tangible examples of alternatives. And so the films that we show and screen, especially in 2019 and 2020, we haven't been able to do, like, in-person screenings of late, but they were all organizations or people or movements who are doing something different. And then we would bring in organizers with kind of corresponding work and have conversations about, like, okay, you just saw this film about a Black doula who is, like, getting Black women to breastfeed in, like, a really important, necessary, like, crucial way. And here she lives in California, but, like, here are Black doulas here in the DMV, and, like, here are direct ways you can get involved. So just, like, really, like, simplifying what is the work, who are the people doing it, and how do you get involved? And I think film, and this is why I chose this medium for current movements as, like, our primary medium, is, like, it's so, like, you see it and then you understand it, right? If it's a well-done film. And, like, we just need more of that. We need more creative works showing our vision, like, our, as in the collective movement, for what's possible, so that more and more people can come on board and get involved and see, like, that it's not a pie in the sky thing. Like, it's actually happening right now. And when we were first starting current movements, an idea we had was, like, to do workshops. And so, like, okay, here we just produced this film about this, like, amazing mutual aid work that's happening in DC. And this is how they were able to feed 1,000 people every week with $10, or I don't know, whatever they're doing. And maybe you in San Antonio, Texas can do something similar and learn from this model. And here's a workshop on, like, how to do it. Here's direct contacts with people who are doing it. And so, like, I would love to get to more of that eventually, but I think, yeah, just, like, showing films, creating art, telling the stories, or like giving a platform for others to tell their stories. And then we're doing this series with the Anacostia-Smithsonian Museum called Knowing Our Past, Creating Our Future. We've been looking at what is the history of alternative institution building in DC. And so we bring together elders in our movement, which DC doesn't have a lot of. Like, there's not a lot of intergenerational movement conversations. And so I really wanted to build upon that because of this, like, because they've done so many beautiful things and we can, like, learn and grow from them. But so this series, like, takes elders and youth or young people and puts them in conversation of, like, okay, this is what we did, or this is what we're doing. And audience, this is like how you can get involved. And so this month is on the environmental justice movement in DC. And just looking at the environmental movement, which is super white, and how Black folks in DC have like reclaimed that for themselves and done like really beautiful climate environmental work, which we don't really hear much about in DC. So I don't know if that answered your question, but that's what I got.
Yeah, that was beautiful. You gave concrete examples how to use creativity, how they interplay with each other, that imagination and creativity. And I look forward to this recent work coming out. I love any work that puts elders and youth together in conversation to showing those lineages. And also it's really important to disrupt the whiteness and environmental movement. I mean, it goes back to Western thought and whiteness and colonialism, that nature is something outside of us. I mean, it's just rotten at the beginning. So I'm so grateful for everyone who's trying to disrupt that. It takes a lot of imagination. Curious. You did mention, of course, our favorites, Robin. But is there a book that was a spark for you? And maybe you can, or a song or a film. I agree with you. Films get your feelings involved quicker. and feel free to name a few and maybe even something to recommend to our listeners.
So a spark like at the beginning or something currently?
Sparks happen all along the way, but yeah, whatever sparks you to say.
Another book that I read this year that I really enjoyed was The Cooking Gene by Michael W. Twitty, who is a DMV guy also, but has been featured on High on the Hog, which is like a Netflix show. And he looks at the intersections between race, food, farming, cooking, and oppression, but also like possibilities and imagination. And so, like with Robin and with Michael, like I've been really inspired more, like less, like getting away more from the political and more into the like tangible, like earth, nature, food. Like how do we bring our analysis into other realms that are also like more nourishing too, like being in nature and enjoying a delicious meal or preparing a delicious meal. Have that balance that I'm seeking in my life where it's not just like direct action, protests, like anger, like being upset all the time, but like, how can I also enjoy this life? So I think those two books bring a good balance, and have to me. I think like early on films, well, all the Black Panther films that came out around like 2014 ish, like The Vanguard of the Revolution, Black Power Mixtape were awesome. And really pulled me into wanting, like, I would just like cry during those movies and just be like, I want to be a part of the Black radical movement. Like, I feel like any moment that I'm not is just wasted. So those like really pushed me to quit my job and to join BLM. But then like earlier on than that, like in 2007 or so, like Food Inc. and like different like documentaries like that. I was already a vegetarian, but like helped me see like what a documentary can do to like push a conversation and push people into life changes, because there was a lot of like commotion around Food Inc. and like the subsequent films that came after that. But I've been like, even more than those like longer films, there's like a short call to action film that came out during Standing Rock that LaDonna Brave Bull put together, or I don't know her like direct involvement, but she was featured and it was like her talking about like what was happening in Standing Rock and why she wanted people to come to her camp and her land and kind of like rally behind her cause to support, yeah, that movement and her specific family, even because the pipeline was going to go through her own son's grave. And so like that film was just like haunting me and also was like, okay, I need to like, this woman is asking everyone to come. Like I want to go and be there and support. And it was, I was able to like have a very clear vision of like what I was going into, you know, because of the footage and the B-roll. But, and then a song, the song that came to my head was Little Boxes. Do you know that song? One of my peace studies teachers, he would sing that song. He would sing a lot of like white folk songs that were used in the different movements of the 60s and 70s during our classes. But that one always stuck out to me because I was like, yeah, why do we want to live in these little boxes that all look just the same? Like, what is this about? Like, and it's a little bit of that imagination piece, right? Like the satire around, like, why do we conform to wanting to all be exactly alike when there's so much more that's possible? So, yeah, I think there's so many, like, Eleanor, like you sing and you do media and like film, like, yeah, there's so many important components of the arts that can really push us to be better and to strive to learn more. So thanks for the question.
Yeah. Thank you for the answer. I think, I can't remember who it was. I think it was actually an anthropologist that had worked in the caves at Lascaux in France, where they found, you know, like handprints and art from whatever it is, like 40,000 years ago. And she said, art is how we communicated before language. Mm. And I still think that's true because I think, at least for me, like I'm bilingual fluently, and then I speak smatterings of like Spanish and French, but there are times like, I just can't, there's certain shit you just can't explain. And so you're like, but I could sing it. I could play it. I could draw it. I like art is just a way for us to emotionally connect, and language is a way. It's like a tool, but art is a direct way. Like you don't need the bridge of language. And so I think about that oftentimes when I'm throwing shit out into the world. So you mentioned, you know, part of your work in connecting elders and youth. And so one of the questions that we ask is like, as a way to fold time and weave the past and present together, can you name an organizer or a collective or a thinker who inspired you? And as well, can you name someone who's newer, who's just starting out, doesn't have to be young, just could be somebody that's just starting out who really inspires you?
Yeah, there's so many. And I appreciate you doing this. We, in our podcast, we start off with highlighting different movement elders, because I think it's important to do that. I think, well, Ella Baker is always someone that I go to. I think like as a Southerner, as someone who really like cared a lot about youth and young people, and just like a brilliant strategic mind. I also think about, well, earlier in the conversation, I was thinking about my great, 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 great grandmother, Joanna Hardiman, who wasn't an organizer per se, but like deeply believed in mutual aid and was, she was the last person to be enslaved. She was freed in, I believe she was 2 or 3 when she was freed. And she, for some reason, was taught how to read and write. And at the school that she went to, it was a Negro school, and her eventual husband was the teacher. And he died during the 1918 flu. And one or two of their children also passed. And during that time, there was a geologist from Washington State coming to Texas, and he had done some work and was like, there are like massive oil reserves under this specific swath of land. And so he went door to door specifically to the Black people who had just, you know, maybe 50 years before that been freed, and asking for their mineral rights. So not their land, just the mineral rights, and was able to get a lot of oil that way. And she saw this coming and went to the courthouse and put the mineral rights in her own name and her children's names, and then hired a oil company to come and to dig or whatever they do, I don't know, but struck oil. And with that money was able to, those same wells have been pumping for over 100 years now, like supporting my family in a way that like the vast majority of Black people in that region, or, you know, really throughout the country, like haven't been able to have. But she put that money into like her neighbors' beauty salons and like different like shops and all these different businesses, allowing for the Black community in that region to, yeah, thrive in a way. Thrive might be a strong word because they were still living through Jim Crow in the middle of Texas, but, you know, like have a space and place for, them to start to live out that Venn diagram. Yeah. So I think about her a lot, and then the complexity of like how her and all of her children then died of cancer because of the oil fumes, you know, and like what all that means. But yeah, I think there's like so many beautiful people in this world who live with that mutual aid spirit, who aren't necessarily like named movement elders. Yeah. And then young people, I am pretty constantly inspired. Like, I'm just so grateful for so many people in DC to have come up this last year through mutual aid and through Uprising. And so those younger groups really inspire me. There was a protest on the mall at the White House, the People versus Fossil Fuel protest, of Indigenous youth primarily coming in from all over the country. And so at Eaton, we hosted a lot of them, and just hearing stories. It was pretty, so there's two stories, and it, so like this like solidarity came both ways. So there's one story was like, Indigenous youth, I was chatting with them like one day when they were just coming back from actions and protests and doing what they do. And I was telling them about an art show that we were doing at Eaton based in on Harriet's Wildest Dreams, the abolition organizing group, and a trip they took with the Coalition of Concerned Mothers, who are mothers who've lost children to police and police state and street violence. And so it was a beautiful trip. And then the art that came out of it is also really beautiful. So I was telling them like, hey, there's going to be like a free like reception with like food and drinks, like come through, like celebrate, like make community, build community. And they're like, oh yes, that's amazing. That's exactly what we should be doing. Like as we're here on in this city that isn't our own, like we should be building with collectives and communities that are fighting day in and day out here. And so that was on a Wednesday, and Friday they came to the reception. I was like, oh my God, I'm so glad you're here. Thank you for being here. And they're like, of course. And like, we were also able to connect with there was also a murder of a young Black man that week, and they were able to connect with the organizers and go to the vigil of I think it was in Southeast, and they were able to go to that vigil and like build those relationships and show that solidarity, which yeah, I thought was really, really powerful and cool, and like not something that I think even 5 years ago organizers like myself or other organizers would have like.
Bonsoir tout le monde. Oui, vous ne vous trompez pas, vous êtes bien à l'émission Café sur les ondes de CKUT. Mais cette semaine, je me suis permise de changer l'intro de l'émission pour vous mettre dans l'ambiance de ce qui s'en vient. Pour bien commencer cette fin de semaine d'Halloween, l'équipe de Café a plongé dans la thématique de l'horreur et vous a préparé une émission aux saveurs sombres et terrifiques qui saura, l'espère-t-on, combler vos appétits culturels pour ce vaste champ artistique. Pour commencer, Ève Laurence, notre fidèle collaboratrice, dans un profond besoin d'oublier qu'il faut qu'elle écrive sa thèse, a composé un segment musico-cauchemardesque festif avec la musique de Mantissa, remixée par Ciel, le groupe de hip-hop Clipping et les projets sombres et occultes Blood and Dust et Natural Snow Building. Ensuite, Esther B. a préparé une critique du film qui vous fera frissonner, Last Night in Soho, du réalisateur Edgar Wright. Quant à moi, je me suis plongée dans le visionnement du tout dernier film du réalisateur Sion Sono, soit le western apocalyptique d'horreur américano-japonais Prisoners of the Ghost Land. Il est 18h02, c'est Alex qui vous parle et je vous souhaite une très bonne émission.